The presidential motorcade had just passed through heavy crowds in downtown Dallas and was circling through the fringes of the business district when three shots suddenly rang out.
Destroying the media lies and dismantling the narratives. One story at a time. It's the Adrian Slade Show.
You know, education is the battleground that the liberals have understood that they should take first. They've understood the battleground for shaping a nation is through education. And it's something I worry about. You know, I've got two kids. They're going to be growing up in this country of insanity. And how education shapes them is first and foremost on my mind. It's one of the reasons why I even did this podcast. One of the reasons why I even started one. One of the reasons was because, you know, I have a radio background and it was mostly in music radio, but I have strong political views and I kind of wanted to be able to flex my political views with my radio background and provide some sort of platform. But I also did it because I want to be able to archive it and have my kids be able to listen to it later so they could kind of see where I stood on things and they could kind of also get an idea as to why I believe the things I do, why I believe in them the way I believe in them. And so education is something that I'm concerned about for them when they get older. I mean, they're soaking up things like sponges right now, and it's amazing to me the things that they learn. But when I look at some of the news stories that are coming out about what they're doing in higher education, first off, that is really just amazing. I mean, from campus reform, listen to this story. Public museums and memorials serve our nation's foundational commitments to white heterosexual male supremacy, according to two Texas A&M University professors. Two women's studies professors argue in a recent article that most commemorative sites are problematic because they support, not challenge, mainstream democratic values and figures. See, there's a problem right there. What they're concerned about is when you're seeing a monument that you're automatically being skewed towards a Republican viewpoint because Republicanism favors patriotism, favors love of nation, favors love of founding. Whereas the Democrat Party doesn't seem to anymore. That died years ago. But going on with this article, public museums and memorials serve our nation's foundational commitments to white heterosexual male supremacy, says Tasha N. Darbwini and Christian Piernot. I probably botched those names, but who cares? They're both irrelevant idiots anyways. Both of whom teach women's studies, another irrelevant course in my mind. I mean, women's studies, yeah, I get that you want to learn about famous women in history and what have you, and that's great. We should laud those people and we should praise the work that they did. But a women's studies course, whatever. But this is at Texas A&M University. And this article was alleging that U.S. commemorative practices serve an inherently conservative agenda. Quote, scholars constantly and consistently argue that U.S. commemorative practices and traditions promote historical narratives that are inherently conservative in nature. This is particularly true of official sites of public memory like memorials and museums. Museums and memorials, they explain, are likely to support, not challenge, mainstream democratic values and figures, reinforcing key aspects of American mythology, including a national dedication to equality, liberty, work, sacrifice, ingenuity, and heroism. So apparently to these professors, that's American mythology, to actually, you know, praise life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, pursuit of private property, hard work, patriotism. All of that is supposedly mythology. But going on with this article, the authors quickly make it clear their distaste for such values, saying that they mask foundational commitments to white heterosexual male supremacy, class hierarchies, and the systemic violence used to secure them. In short, the embodiment of the American identity in commemorative sites is, more often than not, a white, heterosexual, cisgendered male reaffirming the great man perspective that dominated American historiography, whatever, for too long, they add. Professor Tasha Durbuini told Campus Reform that her interest in the subject started with the idea to conduct a research project on the relation between second-wave feminism and public memory, asserting that, quote, there is a striking lack of official commemorative sites, statues, parks, etc., recognizing feminist activists generally, and spaces that remember women from the 1960s and 1970s are basically non-existent. Memorials would go a long way toward reconfiguring conversations about race in the present, she predicted. Public memories matter because they fuel our contemporary understandings of race and gender. Now, see, these idiots sit around their desk and they just pontificate on things without actually thinking about what these things really mean. I mean, I guess we're assuming that the Washington Monument is just a white phallic representation of male dominance, like a horny pooch, white and erect to hump and rape female American populations and casting its shadow across the capital of the United States. I mean, let's look at the actual design of the Washington Monument. On September 23rd, 1835, the Board of Managers of the Society described their expectations of the Washington Monument as, quote, it is proposed that the contemplated monument shall be like him in whose honor it is to be constructed, unparalleled in the world, and commiserate with the gratitude, liberality, and patriotism of the people by whom it is to be erected. It should blend stupendousness with elegance and be of such magnitude and beauty as to be an object of pride to the American people and the admiration of all who see it. Its material is intended to be wholly American and to be of marble and granite brought from each state, that each state may participate in the glory of contributing material as well as in funds to its construction. So it sounds to me like that is actually just praising America, praising George Washington, a man who served the country at the request of those who put him in office and then slipped off into the night with humility. He didn't decide, hey, I want to stay a third term like FDR, the leftist hero. He didn't decide, hey, maybe I want to run for the UN. Let's make the UN like Bill Clinton like wanted to do. I mean, these people who are obsessed with power, they want to praise, you know, people like Obama who are setting the stage for some great one world government. And they get into positions of influence, such as being professors, and they do these ridiculous courses like women's studies course, and then they bring us stupid premises like this. I mean, think about this. From Heat Street, the chancellor of California's community college has raised eyebrows, suggesting colleges should drop the algebra requirement, claiming it's a civil rights issue. I mean, see, we're already removing our monuments, reminders of things that hurt, which help us grow, things that help us learn from mistakes that we've made, reminders that we have the ability to make choices, whether they're good or bad, whether we want to rise up and take a stand on something, whether it's a good stand or a bad stand, we're removing all that. But we're also dumbing down our future. We're dumbing down those coming up through things like removing the algebra graduation requirement or things like Common Core. Going back to this article in Heat Street, Aloy Oakley, the boss of 113 community colleges in California, made his suggestion during an interview with NPR. He said the algebra requirement is particularly troublesome because it prevents a number of students from graduating from community colleges, adding that almost 50% of the students don't meet the standard. Quote, this is a civil rights issue, but this is also something that plagues Americans, particularly low-income Americans. Why? So the low-income Americans just can't learn algebra? Maybe it's because they're not being taught correctly. Maybe it's because we don't decide we want to keep a good standard. You know, we don't want a standard within our school system. We want to spend all this time talking, you know, transgender bathrooms. We want to spend all this time going back and forth about whether or not monuments are phallic-shaped and dominance of white male heterosexuality, and we want to talk about, you know, museums being something against Democrat values and being something that's inherently conservative. It's ridiculous what's going on in the school system, and our kids are going to be recipients of it. And we have to look at the fact that there's a reason why the government subsidized and took over the student loan industry. There's also a reason why they're now talking free college in their platform. Because what's going to end up happening is when they've controlled all the finances and you're indebted to the government, they're going to find a way to, hey, we can just go ahead and get rid of that student loan. We'll do you a solid, but you have to do us a solid in return. You have to do some public service. For what? Maybe organizing for America, organizing for Obama, maybe whatever these community organizing groups that they set up, these nonprofit organizations that they're out there reorganizing the world with. If we're going to get into these nonprofit, non-governmental NGO organizations, and we're going to make you do work that's going to make you feel just good inside because you're making a difference. You're helping the world, and you're going to be a good steward and a good shepherd for the government. And you're going to do all this while you're being indoctrinated on the higher education level. But now they're taking it even further. They're taking it down to grade school. Back in a second.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
If you think the insanity of progressivism is only running rampant in the halls of the centers of higher learning that you're paying thousands for, then grab your colostomy bags because it's trickling down into the public school sector. You thought it was all about reading, writing, and arithmetic, huh? Do you want to know why, out of all the executive nominations that the president picked, that Betsy DeVos caused the most outrage? That's because they want to protect their petri dish of progressivism. I mean, they want to oversee what's being fostered in the school system. It's how they breed Antifa. It's how they breed frothing mouth Trigglypuffs. You remember Trigglypuff? She was the one who sat down in the middle of the street and melted down when the official inauguration solidified President Trump's term in stone. It's how you end up with college freshmen straight out of high school, glowingly praising socialism, but completely unable to even explain what the terminology even means. This is how we get here, because of a curriculum that has dumbed down our youth and is overseen by socialists. It's overseen by the progressives. I mean, listen to this story that's going on in Minnesota. A transgender toolkit for public schools in Minnesota advises teachers to call children scholars instead of boys and girls. We're just going to call them scholars. The guidelines were approved Wednesday by the School Safety Technical Assistance Council and will be distributed to kindergarten through 12th grade public schools and charter schools throughout the state. This is from the Washington Free Beacon. The toolkit attempts to, quote, ensure a safe and supportive transition for children becoming a different gender at school. Yeah, because that's what they need to be learning. Never mind, we're not going to teach about, you know, World War II. We're not going to teach why we bombed Japan twice. You know, why did we bomb? Oh, we bombed them because we're imperialist bastards. We just wanted to go over there and just wreck the place. We're not even going to attempt to talk about the fact that they didn't even give in and surrender after the second bombing. That's how much resolve they had in fighting us. Nah, we're not going to talk about that. Let's talk about how little Aiden over here is picking up Malibu Barbie. And that means we're going to change his name to Brayden. And in fact, the next time we have a war, maybe we have World War III, the entire line is going to have these new neo names of these new birth names that are all the trend these days. Maybe we'll have Braydens and Trevors all on the front line shooting at ISIS. Why not? Back to the story. The toolkit allows for boys who identify as girls to use girls' bathrooms and tells teachers to ask kids what their preferred pronouns are. Because, yeah, the kindergarten kid should set the agenda. The kindergarten kid should say, hey, I want to use the girls' restroom. I mean, like, my son, who is graduated from kindergarten this past year, yeah, he walks in with the Rubik's Cube that he decided to scramble up and puts it down in front of me and says, okay, fix this. Go ahead and fix it. Yeah, he's setting the agenda. He wants me to fix the Rubik's Cube. I had to tell him I had a Rubik's Cube for 15 years and I never fixed it. You know what I did? I took it apart. And actually, he saw a video where they took it apart. He actually suggested that. So, you know, they're smart in that regard. But they're smart enough to realize that they're being inundated with this stuff. And that's one of the things that should concern you. Back to this article. The Minnesota Department of Education encourages parents to have acceptance and support of their child's gender identity if they want their children to perform well at school. Quote, schools should not assume a student's name or pronoun, the toolkit states. School officials should ask the student and use the requested name and pronouns. The department says no legal documents are needed to change a student's name or gender in school records. The department also says that teachers must call students by whatever name they choose to ensure that bullying does not occur. Yeah, call them whatever name. Maybe they want to be called Mighty Morphin Power Ranger Unicorn, Buttsnot. I don't know. I mean, they can pick whatever name they can. They're able to thanks to the transgender toolkit. When students are referred to by the wrong pronoun by peers or school staff, students may feel intimidated, threatened, harassed, or bullied, the toolkit states. School staff, because that's how they operate these days. School staff can ensure a more respectable environment for all students when efforts are made to correct the misuse of pronouns as well as names in students' records. If a teacher calls a child by the wrong pronoun, he could violate the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. According to the guide, teachers should also avoid calling grade school children boys and girls because the phrase is not inclusive. There we are with the inclusivity. Teachers could address students as students or scholars to be inclusive, as opposed to boys and girls, the guide states. Other tips include not picking on a homecoming prom king or queen. Instead, students should nominate prom ambassadors. Yeah, we should have a prom ambassador, homecoming court, or homecoming royalty. The department explains, quote, language around gender is evolving. No, it's only evolving because you idiots are pushing this wackadoo agenda. Continuing, in some communities, the term two-spirit is used for an American Indian person possessing a blend of male and female spirits. You gotta be kidding me. The toolkit states, the term honors people of Native heritage. Two-spirit students traditionally do not seek out medical transition, nor use the language of transgender, nor gender non-conforming to describe their gender. I mean, this is completely confusing. I mean, this is, so, you know, like I said, little Johnny picks up Malibu Barbie. Next thing you know, we're pumping him full of hormones. Next thing you know, he ends up on his own TLC show like I Am Jazz. And next thing you know, he's up in front of the UN at age 12 talking about human rights. We've come to find out later, little Jazz can't get the surgery, the little bottom surgery. They make it sound so nice, bottom surgery, because the hormones that they injected him with at such a young age didn't allow them to be fully developed to be able to utilize the parts. So this insanity that we're dealing with in schools has nothing to do with learning, has nothing to do with intellectual fostering. It has to do with playing this game, this progressive game of confusion. I mean, look what we're doing. We're worried about inclusivity. We're worried about bullying. But why are we worried about bullying when we have somebody like Yvette Falasara, who is the Berkeley Middle School teacher, who decided she was going to get in a fight with with a protest group out in Sacramento last year? She was finally charged. I mean, why are we worried about this. I mean, she got into a fight. She was captured on video hitting a member of the Traditional Workers Party. She got into a fight with a white nationalist group. Now, you may say, hey, she's fighting a white nationalist group. That can't be so bad. Doing it on the steps of the state capitol. Well, she's a member of the By Any Means Necessary group. Yeah, the counter protest blocked the rally that the Transitional Workers Party was having. Chasing and hitting the members of the party, at least 10 people suffered stab wounds and lacerations. She was calling a man a Nazi, punching him in the stomach and saying, get the F off the streets. The brawl between the protesters and counter-protesters resulted in 14 reported injuries as well as thousands of dollars in property damage on the Capitol grounds. California Highway Patrol spent 8 months investigating the rally and its aftermath and turned in a 2,000-page report. You know, the district attorney's office didn't even announce that Ms. Felisara would be arraigned. They said they're still gathering information. They had no comment at the time. Now, whether or not she was fired, it remained to be seen for a period of time. But she had been involved in the 2014 Black Lives Matter protest. This is a middle school teacher. She participated in a number of rallies that turned violent, protested Milo Yiannopoulos, his appearance at the University of California, Berkeley on February 1st of this past year, and directly confronted pro-Trump protesters on March 4th and April 15th at rallies in the Civic Center Park that turned violent. So this is your teachers who are inclusive, those who don't want to bully, those who want to push this crazy agenda, because, you know, we don't want them to be misogynist and homophobic and racist. And, you know, this all stems from this progressive ideology of public schools. Remember, John Dewey was the one who started this all back in the turn of the century, back in the 1900s. He was an educator, philosopher. He's an atheist. He was the one who was the author of the book Democracy in Education. In 1916, that book was the one that helped shape secular relativism in public schools. He rejected the notion of a single, fixed, transcendent reality or higher power. He eventually turned to atheism. Even with his heavily religious upbringing, he dismissed concepts like virtue, asserting that honesty and chastity and courage and industry were not private possessions of the individual, but instead were called working adaptations of personal capabilities and capacities with environing forces. Views the role of the collective with public education and socialization. He preached that morality is social, as are ethics, and students are not individual human beings with private thoughts or feelings. They were part of the collective experience of human beings. He was a progressive that viewed humanity and history was constantly changing and moving forward. He believed that the United States, for it to survive, American democracy must be transformed by a revolution in education, which would be followed by social and economic revolution. He viewed that pursuing political and social change through politics was really slow, where through education it would be much quicker and more efficient. A central theme in his book, In Democracy and Education, and many radical children of the 1960s embraced this way of thinking while heading to places like Columbia University to earn graduate degrees in education, ultimately becoming tenured professors as we see today. And he agreed with Karl Marx on religion. And in 1935, in a glowing review of a book by prized student, Columbia University colleague, atheist, and Joseph Stalin apologist, Corliss Lamont, asserted that religion is the opium of the peoples. He also said that religion has lost itself in cults, dogma, and myths. And this is why the education system has evolved over time that has put us in this place. So it's trickled down from higher education, and as we have progressed into generations of educated and dumbed down progressivism, we have come to a place where we're dealing with uneducated, socialized, progressive, indoctrinated soldiers for their movement. And we're going to get into the mindset of the socialist and how they view overall your children on the other side of the break.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
So through higher education, through public schools, the progressives have taken control of your children. They've taken control of the agenda, the ideology, and the founding of the nation. And they are the ones that are progressively fundamentally transforming the nation right alongside what Obama and his ilk have done. Now, I know you're familiar with the story of Charlie Gard, or maybe you're not. He was the child in England with the terminal disease where he could have gotten experimental treatment. And due to fantastic single payer of the European Union, he can't get the treatment he needs. Even so much down to the United States granting him, limited citizenship so he could come to America and receive that treatment. The single payer method that progressives want for our medical system basically made this cumbersome process to where just because he was hooked up to a government medical device, a ventilator, he wouldn't be able to travel with that device. You would have to go through a court system to see if it's actually viable for this child to leave the ventilator and go to America to get the experimental treatment. And, you know, a death panel would decide whether or not it was in the best interest of the child. Not the parents, but the panel would decide, a governmental panel, whether or not it's in the child's best interest. And that's what you get through a bureaucracy. You sit through this long chain of paperwork, triplicate forms. You go before a court or a panel, and these bureaucrats sit down, and they don't have any sort of stake in the game. They don't have any sort of emotion tied to it. They don't have any sort of care, and they look at it and go, well, I don't know. Nah, I don't think it's not going to work. And by the time they actually had some sort of approval, well, it was too late. And so they decided they're going to take the child home to live his last days. And the Guardian, this is just to give you an idea of the mindset behind the liberal progressive that we talked about that's running the education systems that your children are going through that we talked about the last couple segments. Listen to this from the Guardian. Do we accept that there should be principles and rules, whatever the circumstances that guide us as we try to work out what's best for Charlie Gard? We can, of course, reject such a view and choose to go with the heart and emotions. And the title is, Despite Charlie Gard's Tragic Story, We Must Respect the Process of Our Courts. See, they're giving the courts all the power in this. But continuing, whatever the circumstances that guide us as we try to work out what's best, we can, of course, reject such a view and choose to go with the heart and emotions. But if we do, whose heart should prevail when there are conflicting views? Where there is a conflict, how do you resolve it? Alternatively, we can reason our way through. Cold as this may appear, we can accept the idea of principles and rules. And if reason is to prevail, you need to analyze how to proceed. These are the steps. Now listen to this. The first is to recognize that children do not belong to their parents. Yeah. Let me read that again. Children do not belong to their parents. Second, when a claim is made that parents have rights over their children, it is important to step back and examine the language used. We need to remind ourselves that parents do not have rights regarding their children. They only have duties, the principal duty being to act in their children's best interest. This has been part of the fabric of our law and our society for a long time. Third, if we are concerned with the language of the rights, it is, of course, children who have rights. Any rights that parents have exist only to protect their children's rights, although those rights go away if they're not completely out of the womb yet. I mean, it's amazing to me. But further, parents cannot always be the ultimate arbiters of their children's interest. Really? Going on. Now, in giving effect to a child's rights, the parents' views as to their children's interests should usually be respected, but parents cannot always be the ultimate arbiters of their child's interest. If parents, for example, insist on subjecting their children to a particular diet that, in the view of others, with acknowledged expertise in the subject, will harm the children, We cannot stand by, although we can step in and snip them before they get out the womb, Kermit Gosnell style, but that's a whole nother story. We intervene to safeguard the child once they're out of the womb. See, I'm adding some commentary. I'm sorry. Back to the story. When such concerns arise, there has to be a mechanism to decide the circumstances in which parents' views should not prevail. That mechanism has to be trustworthy, an independent source of authority, sometimes a local authority, but ultimately, as ever, in a civic society, a court. The court's sole concern must be, can only be, for the child and the child's interest. Evidence and views, particularly those of the child's parents, must be listened to. The court must then decide and, crucially, make its decision and reasoning public, exposing to its scrutiny and holding it to account. The court is not infallible. That is why we allow for appeals, a kind of second thought. But ultimately, we are not in the realm of there being a right answer. We are in the realm of judgment, reasoned judgment, and we look to the courts to provide this reasoned judgment. This process depends on a course of acceptance of the supremacy of reasoned argument over passion and the acceptance of the independence of authority of the courts. Campaigns against the courts, whether led by tabloid newspapers, organized through social media, or exploited by sectional and religious groups, are increasingly a feature of modern discourse. It's one thing to comment on and criticize a particular decision. It's a different thing to attack the institution of the courts. Here, in Charlie Gard's case, the call has been to keep the courts out. They don't understand. Only the parents should decide. Let passion prevail. Those behind such calls should reflect on what they wish for and, in their case, get it. The whole system designed to address dispassionately the rights and interests of the children should be pushed aside. And perhaps they should think of that little boy in Auckland. You see, that is the mindset of the progressive. You're too stupid to make decisions for your children because the children don't even belong to you. It's the Hillary Clinton, it takes a village. You know, you can't raise your child because you're too dumb to even have one. And you know what? You might not effectively take care of your child the right way, and your child may end up affecting your neighbor. Your child may end up being somebody who takes up the resources, takes up the economic resources, utilizes the food resources, the population bomb. These people have this thought of government as being the overseer. The government court is the God. And that's the thing. If you remove God, that's what happens. And you know what? One thing that people don't realize, going back to education, what we talked about earlier is the church was involved with education and the church was involved with charity. And the reason being was because, not because they were trying to wield their will of Christianity on people or wield their will of religion. It was because it was also, the church was where the community gathered. Everybody gathered together in that building for the most part. And so, or if they didn't, they were aware of those within the community and they knew the needs that needed to be met. So if somebody was hungry, the church got together and they found that person who may not have even ever been to that church and they took care of the need. They met the need probably more efficiently and more quickly than the government would ever do. They provided education effectively and they did so from a moral standpoint. But the government stepped in for control and they removed that. They removed charity. And now charity comes at a long process. A long bureaucratic process. Same thing with education. Now education has no morality. Now we've got transgender toolkits for kindergarten kids. Now we're worried about monuments and museums being white supremacy and reflections of republicanism that are going against democratism and that we need to go ahead and tear them all down. And we're worried about all of this other stuff other than what should we be learning that makes us a strong nation. And it's all because of progressivism. Progressivism is the biggest disease. And the only reason why they're doing this is because they want governance. They want control. And they're going to do this beyond America. They're going to do this on a global scale. That's why they think of themselves as global citizens. Back in a second.
This is Adrian Slade.
Adrian Slade. Broadcast.
Not to be outdone by public schools and higher education and all the progressive garbage they're teaching in those areas, or the progressive mindset in general that we talked about in the last segment, Planned Parenthood has issued guidelines on its website on how to talk to preschoolers about transgenderism and pleasuring themselves. Because what we need is a lecture by an organization that is funded by our tax money, that decided to take tons of tax money, go to a candidate who doesn't even represent or live in the district in Georgia, fund them to the teeth, have them blow all the money on campaign finances to which they failed, turn around and complain about how they're not being funded properly, or they might be defunded by the lack of Affordable Health Care Coverage Act, once if that gets repealed, and then turn around and have Lena Dunham go out there and shill for them, raising funds by selling a tear-stained soaked dress that she, you know, cultivated when Donald Trump won office, while the administrative staff, like Cecil Richards et al., goes driving around in Lamborghinis from the sale of body parts of aborted babies to stem cell companies. That's what we need a lecture from, an organization like that. And so they've issued guidelines as to, you know, how to talk to your three-year-old. This is from the Daily Wire. Filling the head of your three-year-old child, who thought that he was a dinosaur last week, with confusing messages about sex and gender? What could possibly go wrong? Under a section concerning preschoolers, the following hyperlink questions are addressed. How do I talk with my preschooler about their body? How do I talk with my preschooler about identity? What should I teach my preschooler about healthy social skills and relationships? How do I talk with my preschooler about personal safety? What should I teach my preschooler about pregnancy and reproduction? What should I teach my preschooler about sex and sexuality? Like most of the topical questions, offering some questionable at best recommendations to parents, the issue of so-called gender identity had some disturbing questions and suggestions. Quote, when it comes to gender, ideas about what it means to be a girl or a boy are everywhere, and these ideas have a big influence on your preschooler. Learn how to talk and teach your kid that gender doesn't limit them to how to talk about different kinds of families, how to know if your kid is transgender, and more, directs Planned Parenthood. The site also explains that not all boys have penises and not all girls have vulvas. You can say that most girls have vulvas and most boys have penises and testicles, suggests the guidelines. While the most simple answer is that girls have vulvas and boys have penises and testicles, that answer isn't true for every boy and girl. Boy, girl, man, and woman are words that describe gender identity, and some people with the gender identities boy or man have vulvas, and some with the gender identity girl or woman have penis and testicles. Your genitals don't make you a boy or girl, says the website. Planned Parenthood even informs parents how to tell if their preschooler is trans or gender nonconforming. So how do you know if your children is trying, or your child is trying to tell you that they're transgender or gender nonconforming, rather than just playing around? Experts say that a transgender kid will tell you their gender identity in such a way that is very definitive. Trans and gender nonconforming kids are consistent. They don't go back and forth about their gender. They are clearly identifying with one particular gender identity. Insistent. They feel very strongly about their identity and get upset when they're told that they're not the gender that they say they are. Persistent. How they identify themselves stays over time. The site recommends that you take your child to a counselor or therapist who's familiar and supportive with LGBTQ identities if they think that they might be trans. Well, if I were to take those benchmarks consistent, well, I mean, my kid one minute likes, you know, Wildcrats and next minute likes Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. If I take insistent, well, yeah, if he wants that daggone Optimus Prime t-shirt, he's going to bug me the death out of it until he gets it, or maybe until he does it, and then he's going to cry about it all day. And that goes for persistence too. So that's not really how we should be setting the bar on this whole thing. So we want to keep in mind, this entire crazy, insane petri dish idea of cultivating this new culture of insanity where you can kind of pick your own gender and you pick whatever kind of identity you want to be with, and nothing is within the nuclear family anymore, is just that. It's to destroy the nuclear family, because the nuclear family is success. The nuclear family builds a population. China just redid their one-child policy. Why did they do that? Well, because they were top-heavy. They were aging out. They needed youth. Same thing with Germany and France. That's why they accepted all those migrants. That's why they accepted all the Syrian refugees, because they were aging out. They needed to have some sort of youth. And so is this a way that they try to manipulate some sort of population control because they're afraid of resources? That's the progressive mindset. We need to look at the fact that the family unit grows strong citizens and builds a strong nation. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Adrian Slade. You can listen to me on Talk America Radio every Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, every Sunday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Listen to the podcast, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play. Tune in. Get the free Roku channel, Adrian Slade Show, right there in your streaming store, and we'll see you next time. We'll be right back.